This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Shaoning, and joining me in the studio this morning is Philip C. It is 6 a.m., Wednesday, the 17th of February, and I do believe the sixth day of the Chinese New Year. So a lot of people will be coming back to the office because it's auspicious to come back on an odd day.
Good luck.
You have to come back on an even day, not an odd day.
Yeah. And on a hump day, which is amazing and great timing.
Yeah, because you come back to work, you work 3 days and then
weekend
again. Yay. Yeah. but I have to say, this time round, right, I don't know whether you, probably it's like every year, like almost every year, this Chinese New Year has been extremely warm. And I wonder whether it's because of global warming, right, and climate change.
So the joke was, well, it's not a joke. The Bloomberg article said, recently that the Arctic weather has caused, global warming has caused this Arctic weather in Texas, which has resulted in higher fuel prices.
Yeah, because Brent is above, $63 per barrel. So it's freezing in Texas, but it's extremely hot in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Well, that's global warming for you guys.
It's a sauna. It's an afternoon sauna every day.
Yeah, and I'm like wondering, when is it ever going to rain?
Well, it was raining quite heavily over the weekend. There was like one day where it was torrential. But yeah, after that, it was like
It's just been hot. And I'm wondering whether it's going to be as hot until Chap Gome. Who knows. But in the meantime, what interesting stories do we have?
Well, there's one article from The Guardian which suggests that history may suggest that we may forget the pandemic sooner than we think.
That's actually going to be a very interesting conversation. Because I somewhat believe that.
Yeah, I think we'll...
Time dulls all senses.
And this article contrasts past pandemics with other events.
Yeah.
And how is it that we can forget those pandemics, but other momentous events, which had less casualties, still are etched in our minds further?
Okay. And then once we come back after this song, we'll be talking about whether men get more actionable feedback than women in the workplace.
I think we'll get a lot of feedback on that. Yeah. Our personal experiences there.
Yeah. So do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Let us know your experiences in the workplace when it comes to evaluations. Or appraisals. Who gives better appraisals? Men or women? And what kind of appraisals at the end of
quality.
The day? Yeah, do you really, really want? What makes a difference to your career?
Well, does it really make a difference whether it's a man or a woman?
Yeah, I think everybody just wants good feedback, right? But first, here's Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Buffalo Soldier by Bob Marley and the Wailers. It is just gone past 6:07 in the morning. It's Wednesday, the 17th of February. And of course, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Shaoning, and I'm joined by Philip C. in the studio this morning. Now, in front of us, very atas journal, Harvard Business Review.
Of course.
Chosen by the one and only Philip C., right?
Atas channels by Atas article, of course.
Let me guess, you're not reading The Sun, but not the Malaysian Sun, but the UK Sun, by the way.
All coconuts.
But anyway, this article is entitled Research: Men Get More Actionable Feedback Than Women. And I think, it's early days of February, and most of us probably have done and dusted our appraisals. We either probably did it at the end of last year or earlier part of this year. And I would say it's one of the tasks I like the least. Not so much in getting the feedback, but sitting down and doing it for everybody. It's very, I would say, quite painful because you try to be as objective as possible. You really want people to improve. And then you never find the right words to put on the paper.
What do you not like about it? Do you not like the fact that they look at it and say, huh, really? That's the feedback given.
No,
the
because it's that challenge, right, whereby you want, it's a bit of that carrot and stick, if that's the right kind of a comparison, in the sense that you want to give the right amount of encouragement. You want to give the direction, right, how to improve. But yet, at the same time, you don't want to be so critical on performance because otherwise it would be just too discouraging.
Yeah.
So how do you pick the things which are really important, maybe the faults, the errors? And I think then where the boss part really comes in is how do you improve on the faults and the errors? There's no point saying, hey, you did this, you did this, you did this, you did this, and then nada, right? There's no point. It's easy to pinpoint. But you're a lousy boss if all you do is pinpoint and you provide no solutions or no encouragement or no direction in terms of improving. And I find that challenging because it's easy to find fault, but it's not easy to find solutions for people or like guide them because they have to find these solutions actually themselves.
Yeah, I wonder the question you're asking is there a distinction in the quality and type of feedback given by gender, right?
Oh, okay.
Do men and women give different types of feedback?
I think yes, from the perspective of receiving it. Okay, so I of course, I've been a machai. Everybody's been a machai. Everybody's had an appraisal, one form or another in today's work. If you've been working for the last 20 years, for sure. And yes, there is a difference between how men give feedback and women give feedback. So men, I notice, especially to another woman, they're quite gentle.
Yes.
Because I've had male bosses say the worst thing they've ever had in their life was a woman cry in their office. They don't know what to do. They panic. Okay. So they already have this kind of sense of, okay, let's not be so mean, you know. And then you can see them want to rush through the process. They wanted it to be done as fast as possible so that you're out there. Okay, done. Tick that box.
I'm guilty of that personally.
Are you?
As a man who being a boss and I give feedback, I must say I am a bit cautious not to be overly aggressive or overly pointed to women.
Okay.
For fear of, you know, all this talk of, you know, sexual harassment and all that. Even though I know I would never do it, it does mute me a bit.
Okay.
And apply some filter, which is not good because a filter means that you don't really tell what is truly what your concern
or
reflection
is. Okay, so why? What are you also then concerned about their women being or the perceived notion that they are softer, that they're more emotional?
I think it's whether how they take the feedback.
Okay.
Which is the point you said, like you don't want to have someone in the room
bursting into tears
and you don't know how to placate that kind of stuff. With guys, I guess, I find like they will just, okay, take it. It is. I say, but I disagree with you. That's not the right feedback. Or here's the evidence, which is the case, right?
Yes.
Whereas I think the woman will be more reflective and thinking it through. Maybe that's true. And then, you know, still not able to land on whether that's correct. But that said, I don't think it's, I think now as we progress, I don't think you can classify the feedback taking so much by gender. But the feedback giving, I think you can distinguish.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I'm a woman, so I can't tell it from a man's perspective, right? But it's true. I do observe something, though. This not so much in terms... I think also, okay, when we have an evaluation, honestly, what we are doing is we're having a conversation. So we are actually answering the other party's questions. Now, my observation about men versus women in the room, you're right. Men are quite focused on their future.
Yeah.
Okay? So they are quite pointed in where they want to go. So they'll ask you as a machai to the boss, what is my career direction in 2 years? I want to be this. How do I get there? So they are quite visionary in their career. Okay, they see a future and they want to head there.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they quite pointedly tell you what are the stumbling blocks. Okay, I don't like this, I don't want to do this.
Yeah, more directional, right?
Yeah.
Do this.
I don't want this. And then they'll give you some evidence of it. Okay. Now, women, on the other hand, are more emotive. Okay. They are like less specific in terms of their vision. They know what they roughly want, but they're perhaps not so pointed in it. And I think, to be fair, we are making a lot of generalizations here, but this is just my own little universe of appraisals.
Well, I want to amplify that because the study here kind of supports that. They, in Harvard, right, this Atas University, they did this study where they applied topic modeling, which is what they did to analyze political tweets. And so when it came to the point about vision, men were encouraged to set the vision, whereas women were encouraged to focus on delivery. And when it came to political skills, men were encouraged to leverage the politics, while women were encouraged to cope with it.
You see, that's the thing. Women, we need to rise above all this. But I think also it's this whole gender bias, let's be honest, is there. Women also have to deal with a lot more obstacles in the first place to get to the career. And along the way, they are also facing daily obstacles, right?
Yeah.
I mean, women bear the brunt, especially COVID-19, with the work and the home and the balancing of that is a challenge. And it's just like I say, like gender bias, like you're told over the last 20, 30 years, you know, that certain kind of messaging does work. You're a woman, be happy, you know, take a step back. And I think today, all sides, men and women have to be more conscious of this. In terms of being a boss and being an employee. And if you're a woman, Why not state what you want up front? Have a vision. Have a goal for yourself.
And it got me thinking, maybe the feedback has to be 360. Perhaps you might get better feedback from your peers and from the people that report to you directly.
Yeah.
So that when you get diverse feedback, then you balance it all out
That's
together.
That's true. Let us know what you think about this. Have you had very bad feedback or very good feedback? And does it matter whether the boss is a man or a woman?
Yeah.
You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or of course tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we'll have some messages and we'll come back. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Down the Line by The Beach Fossils. You're listening to The Morning Run with Wong Xiaoning and Philip C. Seb, it's now 6:18 in the morning, Wednesday, the 17th of February and the 6th day of Chinese New Year. For many people, the first day back to work because it's a nice even number, even day of Chinese New Year. So supposedly better good luck for you. But in front of us, in the meantime, we're talking about this article from The Guardian. And the article title is History Suggests We May Forget the Pandemic Sooner Than We Think. I think this is on the back of the fact that the pandemic has been with us for a year, right? I think close to a year. The first lockdown for Malaysia happened on 18th of March. You know, sadly, it's still with us. And I think a little bit of optimism because we got news yesterday about the national vaccination plan, which we'll be discussing in detail at 7:45. So do tune in. But at the same time, I think with that vaccine optimism is the hope that the pandemic is behind us, right? Or at least we can see some form of a future, a COVID-free future. But I think, to be honest, COVID will always be with us.
Well, there's a conversation now that it will transition from a pandemic to an endemic, right?
Yeah, hopefully it will turn out to be like the regular flu. Right? So
yes,
the number of deaths will be much reduced. We perhaps could go back to some normality, but I think wearing masks is going to be with us. SOPs are going to be with us for quite a while because achieving that herd immunity is going to take a few years.
It will take a long time. And with the mutations coming through, I don't think it's ever going to have a finite end. And that's the point of this article from The Guardian, which I felt was beautifully written, because they were contrasting the early 20th century, and they were saying, look, in the First World War, between 1914 to 1918, 17 million people were killed. But if you compare that to the Spanish flu that struck around the same time, one in three people in the planet, a total of 500 million, you know, were affected, leaving nearly 50 to 100 million dead.
And
you don't really remember much about the Spanish flu. So comparing and contrasting, And this story was written in the UK. If you go to every town in the UK, you will see some plaque or cenotaph from a memorial about the war heroes. But you don't hear much about the Spanish flu, even though the impact on civilization and society was much deeper than the First World War I.
Yeah, you're right. I think, I do remember reading the Spanish flu in history books off and on, but it didn't have that prominence.
Didn't stick.
Yeah, it didn't have the prominence of the World Wars or even the Vietnam War, the Korea War. Somehow that kind of resonates more. And you're right, somehow it's being shoved to the back of history. And only now, today, because of COVID-19, is there so much discussion on these pandemics, whether it's the bubonic plague or the Spanish flu that's happened over the last few centuries. And I think this article tries to explore, right, what are the reasons for this? And I think it boils down to the fact that for COVID or any pandemic, the suffering or the burden you feel is an individual one, not collective one.
Correct. There's a distinction between collective tragedy and personal tragedy. So the war is when we have clear heroes and villains. We are fighting together as a collective, as a country, as a nation, as a collection of, as an alliance to combat and fight this evil. And we know clearly who this evil is. So I think that's why
it's a common enemy.
It's a common enemy. And
but isn't
tangible.
COVID a common enemy? But
exactly. It's tangible. And what is interesting here on the COVID side is, in the war side, there's a tangible side on the heroes and villains, right? They're the soldiers. So on the COVID side, we try and portray our healthcare workers, the frontliners, as the hero. But this villain is an amoebic...
It's like a mysterious thing, right?
Non-entity you can't really see and touch and feel.
There is an enemy, but you can't visualize the enemy.
And it's mutating.
Yeah, okay. Well, yes, sadly it's mutating. But you're right, maybe because there is no visual enemy, there's no baddie. You know, like a visual baddie. It's hard for us to kind of get together and say, okay, this is a collective experience.
If you recall 9/11, that was also a big problem. 9/11, people can remember, but they couldn't.
The Twin Towers
yeah, event is so physical and visual, but they couldn't identify the enemy as well, because terrorism was also a very broad element and it wasn't a clear nation or country. So that's why there was this whole piece about going into war in Afghanistan and Iran, because they needed to identify the enemy to a certain extent, even though rightly or wrongly.
You're right, because I think when you look at World War II, we use that as an example. There's clearly the Allies and the Axis, right? It was very, very defined, right? And it was the Nazis and the rest of the world kind of thing. So you, like in any superheroes, it's true, right? In a superhero, there's a common enemy, whether it's Thanos and the Avengers or whatever. And COVID-19 seems very hard for us to pin down. It doesn't have a face. It has lots of victims, but doesn't have a visual face. And I think that's the issue. The only thing I have about this is, about this article, which worries me, is are we going to learn it?
Yeah.
Because history repeats itself. And are we going to learn the lessons of COVID-19? We didn't really seem to learn the lessons of the Spanish flu because it was forgotten very quickly. So in 20 years' time, if there's another pandemic, or 10 years' time, touch wood, I'm really touching wood on the table in the studio, what lessons are we going to learn?
I'm going to end this on a lighter note. The lesson learned is, let's make sure we immortalize it into movies so that we get this similar and document it in creative ways so people remember the stories. I mean, we talked about this yesterday with Matt Hancock.
Contagion,
right? Got inspired by a fictional story. But let's not create fictional stories. Let's celebrate or even archive and document what actually happened here so that really we learn, because there wasn't really much of that with respect to the Spanish flu, maybe perhaps due to the later lack of technology then.
Yeah, people should actually write down their stories about how they managed during COVID-19, about the loved ones that they've lost, for example, or stories of recovery. I think the other thing that we need to learn is the governments need to learn to beef up their spending on healthcare and not to take it for granted, right? In the past, we've always focused very much on economic growth, and economic growth is important, but public health spending is also equally important. But let us know what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Maybe you have a COVID-19 story you want to share, which we should immortalize. Up next, we have the news bulletin, and to take us there is Starman by David Bowie. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, it's 6:38 in the morning, Wednesday the 17th of February. And of course, you're listening to The Morning Run. And that song was Daughter by Pearl Jam, which is a nice way, it's a nice title, which is related to the next story we have.
The Daughter of Myanmar?
Yes, the Daughter of Myanmar. Because what we do know is Myanmar's detained opposition leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, has been handed a second criminal charge. And now she's alleged to have violated the country's natural disaster management law.
What is that about?
Well, it's in addition to the earlier charge of possessing illegal walkie-talkies. And your point exactly, Philip. It is not clear what the new charges are related to, because Myanmar's military has repeated its promise to hold fresh elections and relinquish power as protests continue. However, no date has been given for the vote. I remember in the early days of this coup, they said 1 year, right? And then now, of course, 1 year...
It's indefinite.
It's indefinite.
It's interesting because indefinite, and then the first charge was walkie-talkie. That clearly didn't stick. So now it's an arbitrary or nebulous rule and law. Just
natural disaster management law. What is that? You cause earthquakes?
Perhaps.
Climate, or perhaps global change.
Or perhaps pandemic related.
I don't know. It's like...
It's hard, right?
Yeah, it's hard. But what we do know is that I think street protests has increased. And so has somewhat, I guess, reaction to that street protest. I think in the early days, it was kind of almost tolerated, all that banging of the pots and the protests where people wore cute costumes, made interesting signs. That was tolerated a little bit, but I think there's a little bit of a harder stance going on.
Yeah,
at the
you're
moment.
Seeing more intensification by the military. I did see a side article which I found fascinating, in which what we saw was that people were beginning to withdraw deposits from military-owned banks. I found that the best form of protest, because if you can't hit them through your protest, why don't you just hit them at the wallet and withdraw all the funds where you feel from these institutions that the military supports.
Yeah, yesterday in the BBC podcast, I heard the same thing. So businesses, small businesses, non-government ones, of course, are also reacting to this. But like what you say, trying to cut their ties with any business that is government-related or military-related as a sign of protest. But I think what is a little bit sad is to know that the, you know, there is some people, I guess, impacted, because there was one lady who took part in the protest following the coup, and she still remains in critical condition after being shot in the head on 9th of February. Not clear what she was hit though, because right groups say her wound is consistent with one from live ammunition. So it's gone a little bit violent there. There have also been reports of police using rubber bullets and tear gas to disperse protesters. So the UN is taking a stance, and they've warned the Myanmar military, which on Monday announced penalties of up to 20 years in prison for those opposing the coup leaders, that there will be a severe consequences for any brutal suppression for the ongoing anti-coup protests there. But there are some commentators who are a little bit surprised, because we are talking about a military dictatorship, in terms of how reserved they've been in their reaction. So they're sporadic, they have shot at some people, but there haven't been large-scale arrests yet. And there was a debate as to why is that not happening. And it's because, apparently, all these protests that are going on are sporadic. There's no real clear leader. So who do they arrest?
It's so dispersed. They just unified over a theme.
Yeah.
But there is no like Joshua Wong.
Yeah.
Who's galvanizing and a lightning rod. The lightning rod is already incarcerated in-house arrest. So it's very hard to do. And these people really clearly love her. And they're just doing it out of protest. And it's very hard to...
Yeah, like
what, them.
Yeah, like who do you arrest? Who's the ringleader, right? And I'm sure even though internet is down,
you can't identify the enemy.
Yeah, you can't identify the enemy. So maybe that's why there's a little bit of restraint. But meanwhile, looking at another ASEAN neighbor, Philippines.
Yes.
Because the Philippines said it has enough orders of coronavirus vaccines in the pipeline to reach its goal of inoculating most of its population this year, even as the country expects a supply crunch in the first half of 2021, they are negotiating for as many as 170 million vaccine doses. And a fourth of the vaccine supply will actually come from the World Health Organization-backed COVAX facilities, with first shipments expected later this month. Now, I think Philippines has been quite hard hit by COVID-19.
Yeah, when you look at the GDP numbers, just among all the ASEAN countries, 2020 numbers are all in already. Philippines had the worst impact among the ASEAN countries at minus 9%. If you compare us with Thailand, Singapore and Malaysia, were 5, 6%, Indonesia minus 2%. Philippines really bore the brunt of this COVID pandemic much more than its ASEAN neighbours.
Well, when you look at the dynamics of the Philippines economy, you can somewhat understand it. And a lot of it, actually, 10% of their GDP actually is remittances.
Yes.
Because they have so many foreign workers, right? Be it on ships or, you know, nurses or even helpers. And with COVID-19, you know, there's a lot more Filipinos who are stuck at home, not working overseas. So remittances have come under pressure, and it's unsurprisingly the economy is suffering.
I'm even worried that there's an informal economy that's not even being recorded here.
Yes,
so
for
the
sure.
impact could be even deeper than that. And while we talk about this, there's still a lot of political machinations still in the Philippines.
Yeah, remember, right? Well, for some of us who still remember, apparently the Philippine Supreme Court has dismissed the election protest of late dictator Ferdinand Marcos' son. Okay, so they're still in the political field, the Marcos name, who was questioning the outcome of the 2016 vice presidential race. So the top court sitting as the electoral tribunal unanimously voted to junk former Senator Bongbong Marcos' protest against the VP and opposition leader Lenny Robredo, because Robredo narrowly beat Marcos for the country's second highest post in the 2016 elections.
Fascinating, because the president and vice president don't necessarily get along. But I find the timing of this court interesting, because it's 2021. This election was 5 years ago. The presidential election in the Philippines is next year. So it's a bit late in the game to contest the result. But what is something to look forward to is apparently the successor for Duterte is his daughter, Sara Duterte.
Well, family legacies not only happen in Malaysia, but clearly happen in Philippines as well. But up next, we'll be taking a look at the front pages of our daily newspapers and online portals. We'll be back after these messages. Don't go away. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Wong Shao Ning with Philip C, and this is The Morning Run. And it's just gone past 6:51 in the morning. It's Wednesday, the 17th of February. And that song was Do You Want To by Franz Ferdinand. Quite a cool song.
Love that song.
I love
you
it.
You want to be lucky?
Yeah. We all want to be lucky all the time, especially during Chinese New Year, okay? I want lots of ang baos. But in the meantime, we're taking a look at some of the local news stories this morning. What do you have in front of you, Philip?
Well, of course, the big news is yesterday, the announcement of the National COVID-19 Immunization Program. The million-dollar question is, who is going to be a frontliner?
Well, I think the obvious one are, of course, the health workers, right? Anyone involved in healthcare, nurses, doctors. I think even for me, you know, what should be included is like cleaners in the hospital. They do an essential service, right?
True.
And they need to be protected. But I guess the big question is, after that,
who?
Yeah, I think the
teachers? Politicians
are next.
Yes, I think they made it very clear all politicians will be vaccinated. But how about teachers? Mm. How about media? How about retail stores?
Yeah, I think...
At what point do you identify who is and who is not really a frontliner?
Yeah, I think even manufacturing, you know, I think factory workers, there were questions about that. So far, if we take the UK for it, as an example, I think they of course did the frontliners. And then after that, it was just the elderly, people in care homes, right? Anyone above 60, 70, that was the priority. And then they're slowly going down the age groups, I think. But there have been calls, even in the UK, to get teachers vaccinated as soon as possible so that children can go back to schools.
It is a very good point, which is the guiding principle and intention. Because if you talk about healthcare and even elderly, it is because you want to avoid hospitalization and
deaths,
reduce death rates.
Yes.
But if you are then shifting the objective to opening the economy, facilitating travel, movement and mobility, then it's a different discussion altogether.
Which is the approach Indonesia is taking. They have come out to say, right, that they want to vaccinate the young and the working force as a priority because they need to get the economy back on track. And for them, I think they hardly practice any physical distancing. It was a real challenge. So I think, you know, which model works, it's a question mark. But I think for us, I'd like to know who's next after the frontliners. I think that's an obvious first choice. But other news, of course, I've got the Edge CEO morning brief in front of me. And it's also related to the vaccine, which we will get into in a little bit more detail at 7:45. But the first vaccines are arriving this Sunday. And our Prime Minister, Tan Sri Muhyiddin, will get his vaccination on February 26th.
Very soon, counting
very,
the days,
very
counting
soon.
The hours.
Yes. And I think the other good news is that new recoveries outnumber infections for the third straight day.
Yeah.
The other news, of course, is that the MCO has been extended till the 4th of March.
So the data is a bit contradicting, I feel, because you hear very good news with respect to recoveries and also the number of infections. At the same time, there's also a discussion of extending the MCO to March 4th. One thing that got me to thinking is the lower numbers due to the lack of testing during the festive period? And
that
that's something
a possibility
to, yeah,
I think
to
so.
Consider, right?
I think the number to pay attention to is R0, right? Mm. How is our R0 doing? And I think it's still quite high on a nationwide basis. Slightly below 1 if I'm correct, but still needs to be brought down to 0.5. I think this is a target. And we are far away from that.
Yeah, 2 days ago it was at 0.89 I saw.
But I think what another piece of news that caught my eye, which is in the Star on page 3, is Pakatan to fully support immunization program. So there is bipartisan support in terms of getting the COVID-19 rollout. The opposition says they will give full support to the federal government. And I think that's a good thing because, yes, I think for once, everybody needs to work on a common purpose, and that is to achieve herd immunity as soon as possible. And everybody needs to work together.
I think this is the same logic happening in the UK, where you saw cross-party support also for the immunization between Labour and the Conservatives, and it's manifested in better numbers.
Yeah.
So
I think, you know,
fully support that. Yeah. That's great news.
And, you know, as soon as we can get our herd immunity back up and maybe the politicians getting their jabs, maybe they can reconvene.
Go into Parliament?
Yeah, they can reconvene Parliament as soon as possible. But the other piece of good news is that hospital bed occupancy rates have fallen.
Mm.
I think that's on the back of recovery. But I would like to emphasize that we still need to practice our SOPs. You know, we still need to maintain that physical distancing, wear your mask, wash your hands, do your part. It's your social responsibility to make sure that the R0 number comes down.
Yeah, so going back to, now shifting away from Malaysia to Indonesia, there were two interesting pieces of news from Indonesia. The first is Traveloka, Southeast Asia's largest online travel startup, and they plan to list in the US using a SPAC.
We've had this discussion on SPACs, right?
On travel.
Yeah, I think SPACs are the latest, hottest thing, like Bitcoin, which, by the way, has hit 50,000, although it has come down a little bit this morning. But I think it's just, you know, the cheap money, lots and lots of cheap money out there and people looking for a home.
But a lot of transactions happening in Indonesia. I mean, early on, we had the Gojek Tokopedia. So this is relatively the latest development happening in Indonesia. The other interesting news is that Indonesia has now appointed its head of its new wealth fund. And he is Rida Wirakusuma. He was a former CEO of Bank Permata, but also held positions at KKR, General Electric. And so he's going to head Indonesia's wealth fund, which is currently having about $15 billion worth of assets, aimed to grow to $100 billion. A bit late in the game, though, for Indonesia.
A bit late, but never too late. I think everybody's looking at how they can best manage their sovereign fund. But that's all we have from the papers this morning. Coming up next is a 7 a.m. news bulletin, followed by more business news and analysis, where we'll be speaking to Jack Kuzi of VFS Group to find out where global markets are heading. But first, here's Bad Reputation by Joan Jett and the Black Hearts. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.